Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on underwriting debt portfolios. Much like credit scores and applying loans, the process for obtaining funding to purchase a portfolio of defaulted accounts can seem like a black box algorithm, but that's not necessarily the case. We're fortunate to have a pair of experts with us today who are going to walk through the underwriting process to help shed light on this important topic. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Flock Specialty Finance. You get the chance to hear about them during our program. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and it's a great resource of news and insight to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Chief of Analytics at Flock Specialty Finance. Damon, with 20 years of experience in the receivables management industry, is Flock's Chief Business Analyst, providing underwriting for new investments, forward evaluation, business intelligence, and valuation for M&A projects. During his time with Flock, the company has funded nearly 1,000 portfolios and evaluated more than 5,000. With Flock, he also oversees the company's client portals and all IT initiatives. Prior to joining Flock Advisors in 2011, Damon served as SVP of Analytics at Eltman & Cooper in New York. While there, he provided an exceptionally high success rate for both portfolio purchase and post-purchase performance. Additionally, Damon developed predictive account-level models, increasing liquidation and efficiency of collection. Between 1997 and 2008, Damon held similar roles with Outsourcing Solutions Incorporated. While at OSI, he developed cost tracking and business intelligence systems, as well as managing their portfolio lender relationships. Damon's from the Atlanta area and earned his Bachelor's of Arts from the Citadel. He and his wife have three sons. He enjoys tennis, hiking, and kayaking. Damon is a volunteer with the Boy Scouts of America, holding multiple positions within the organization. Greg Paulo is the Vice President of Business Development at Flock Specialty Finance. Greg has 25 years of operational and sales experience in the accounts receivable management industry. Most recently, Greg worked at Navient as a Senior Director of Managing the campus, state, and municipal collection sales teams. Prior to Navient, Greg was president of Redline Recovery Services, a mid-sized ARM firm providing accounts receivable management services in the financial, student loan, mortgage, and auto industries. Greg's experience in existing relationships helped Flock leverage its extensive network to provide flexible portfolio capital to underserved markets. Greg graduated from the Loyola University of Chicago with a Bachelor of Arts. He has five children and enjoys playing racquetball, golf, and cycling. Greg's actually feeling a little under the weather today, but he is here and will be available to answer questions both from myself and from the audience. The format for today's webinar will be a presentation from Damon and Greg, and I'll be here to ask questions as well. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the presentation has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. With that, let me turn the microphone over to Damon to begin today's presentation. Damon?
Thank you very much, Mike. Flock is here to talk to you about how we work with our debt buying clients on underwriting debt portfolios to help make sure that our mutual returns are as beneficial to both parties as they possibly can be. We have a series of steps that we go through, very high level, and it's one of those things that pretty much anyone who's doing debt buying really should be doing these processes in order to be able to maximize their returns and minimize their uncertainty around an investment. Hang on one second. A little bit of technical difficulty there. Why is that not moving? A little hiccup on the presentation here, Mike. We're not able to move it. Give me just one second. Thank you. and see if it advances slides when we're in the sharing mode.
You just need to click on the screen or the space bar or the cursor key. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to want to let you, but yeah, it doesn't want to move when I'm in presentation mode, unfortunately. I tell you what we're going to do here. We're going to do this a little, clap the ribbon down.
Well, if you want, you can email me, and I can run the presentation too, if you wanted to try that.
That would be fine. Why don't we do that?
Okay. While you're doing that, maybe you take a couple of minutes and tell people about Flock, who it is, what it does, things like that.
Sure. Greg, why don't you take a shot at that while I work on I'll send this over to Mike.
Well, Flock Finance, today we are a partner. We partner with debt buyers who are in the market buying distressed receivables, typically charged off credit card debt or consumer loans. We also participate in joint venturing in buying performing auto loans in the buy here, pay here industry. We do some tax liens. We do some medical liens. So we have a pretty broad array, diverse set of assets that we invest in with our partners. And we do that on a joint venture basis where our partners own the debt, collect the debt, and we invest directly in that particular asset through a joint venture SPV type structure. As we had said before, we've underwritten about 1,000 deals and looked at over 5,000 deals, and we've been in existence for 6 years under this iteration. Michael Flock, who is the founder, had a previous company which operated more in a fund environment and had run that company for several years before re-engineering it into its current state. All right,
good to know. I'm still waiting. I'm still working on getting that email. But while we're doing that, maybe talk a little bit about, sort of the reason why we're having this discussion today about underwriting, about sort of the underwriting process. Because I know that is something that, a lot of people probably have some questions or are looking to learn a little bit more about. And I know that sort of given the environment for debt purchases, it definitely seems like there's more people that are interested in making that kind of investment today.
Sure. One of the challenges that we find at Flock as we bring on new clients or explore new potential partners in debt buying is that we find that some folks are very, very good collections agencies, but they've never done debt buying before. It's a very different experience and to know what you're actually getting when you buy a portfolio and try to predict its performance as opposed to just trying to maximize your recoveries for the short time you have it as a third-party agency. So we work with a variety of clients. We have several clients who are very sophisticated and use every possible tool, everything from high-level scores to scores they've built themselves, composite portfolio consolidations of existing accounts they've done before to try to impute some sort of a value or estimation of the worth of a portfolio that we're looking at. To at the same time, clients who have very little experience and may not have and may be bidding primarily off of gut or off of what they're just told by a broker. The latter is not a particularly strong way to be able to bid. You can win some deals that way, but you may not perform as strongly as you'd like to perform in your liquidations. That's where Flock comes in. We help our clients that we're jointly investing with to make sure that both parties are minimizing the risk of their investments and maximizing the potential returns.
Damon, you may want to just run the presentation off the screen like you had it.
Is Damon there?
Yeah, I'm here. The problem is we can't. Okay. I sent it over there to you, Mike. You should have it by now. I can't seem to advance the slides while we're in the presentation mode, unfortunately. So that's where we're having a little bit of a challenge, a little technical glitch there.
I have unfortunately not gotten the email yet, but I am kind of standing on top of my inbox waiting for it to come in. I know you kind of got that presentation in front of you.
Well, let's try it like this. Can you see the screen now?
I can see the title screen, yes.
Run it like that.
Okay. So we'll go from here. It's not quite full screen presentation mode, so we are in a little bit of a letterbox format, but it will let us go ahead and move through the presentation this way. I think that'll be a little bit more effective and useful for everyone's time.
So when you get a
data file in from a potential seller, the file looks a lot like what you see up on the screen. We're largely familiar with it, and we have masked some of this data out here, as you can tell. Sometimes you get unmasked data, sometimes you don't, but ultimately the question is, how do you move from seeing all this demographic information and data that's related to how the file stood at the time of charge-off, and move from there to this, which is a prediction of the cumulative liquidation of the portfolio with confidence intervals around its potential recoveries based on what we know about the file. To do that, we're going to go through these stages of underwriting. And these are kind of the stages of the underwriting that Flock feels every client or everybody in the debt buying industry should be doing at a minimum. And we'll go through each of these in detail, but you can see laid out here our concept of where we see the stages that you go through in order to evaluate a potential portfolio. The first step is data cleaning. And really, at the end of the day, there's an old saying in data science, which is garbage in, garbage out. It's very important that when you get your data in from a client, from a potential seller, that data gets cleaned up a little bit. Such things that'll cause problems are invalid data fields. For example, having text entry into a zip code field. Not every originator or provider of accounts has properly mapped their fields. So you get some bleed over. Some of us are fairly familiar with that, where you've got the end users at the originator's data systems have accidentally put numeric fields in where text should be and put in bad fields for date of birth and that sort of thing. I've actually seen files come through with 208-year-old charged off consumers in it. Obviously, there's a data structure issue there. Another issue that you want to look at is string length. If you're going to look at the data, sometimes you've got to make sure that you break up the string data. For example, one of our tools that we use to stratify our files has a string length of 50 characters on the address field. And sometimes if the data file is all stored as one continuous string, you've got a street address followed by a second address field like apartment or PO box, followed by the city, by the state, all in one string, and you've got to break that field up. And the final thing is making sure that all the field codes match up to what you think they should be. Which brings us to stratification. Now, one thing that you can do when you get the raw data file, and we've seen a lot of consumers do this, a lot of our clients do this, is take the file and build ruefully a sea of pivot tables and manually segregating the values. So, for example, breaking down a pivot table build of understanding what state distributions are versus the debtor age distributions and that sort of thing. The challenge of doing a sea of pivot tables is it's very time consuming. It has to be customized and repeated every single time you do it. So it does take a lot of time to do that process. It does give you the benefit of customization, which means that you can try to look for correlations and outliers within the data. For example, you might bucketize the date of birth for a consumer, the consumer's age, and break that down by state, and then try to see whether or not, for example, one particular state has a mass of outliers in it. That would tell you that there might be a problem, or the first pay defaults being a yes or a no field, and seeing whether or not that is extremely an outlier in a particular state or zip code or some other piece of information like that. However, like I said, it takes time. It is usually a secondary step. What you might want to do instead is to actually use a tool yourself that helps you summarize the data. And always summarize data like these pool stratifications makes the data easier to understand. For data scientists, it's useful because it allows us to communicate more effectively with decision makers on the other end. It doesn't do us a whole lot to talk about the beta coefficients between debtor age and delinquency timing or account outstanding timing. We need to be able to show that in a concise format that's easy for our end data consumers to understand. And this is a great tool that we use. Flock actually has partnered with Beam as a collections software provider. They have a tool built into their system that we use to help stratify the data. It also means that it's a little easier for us because we don't have to regularly when we look at a data file, we don't have to update the out-of-statute limitation tables if the laws change. That's taken care of by our vendor in that case. The other big advantage to using a regular tool is most regular tools across most systems that provide those sorts of tools allow you to do field mapping. So the benefit of that is once I've mapped a field one time for a particular data file coming from a particular originator, I don't have to go back and remap those fields every single time. It makes the import of data into the system to do the stratification much quicker and much more rapid. Again, a lot of systems use that. We, again, tend to use Beam because it is fairly straightforward and we're able to save all of those field mappings that we use. The reason why that's really important is if you're buying a flow of paper, one really important thing to do is always compare each subsequent flow to the prior files to make sure the files aren't changing on you. I'd like to tell a story about when I was at OSI, we had a healthcare club provider that we were buying a flow of inventory from, and we were not stratifying the file as regularly as we should have. And we went 3 months before we realized that the percentage of the file that was California had jumped by about 50%. And that explained why the performance over that 3 months had been dipping. So always a good practice, even on flows, even on things you think you know what you're doing with, to always be double checking the file. That leads us into data mining. And data mining has a couple of different component pieces to it. Data mining may include building or obtaining customized scores from some of the commercial providers, batch tracks, or building a composite portfolio. When we talk about batch tracks, that's probably one of the most useful pieces of information, particularly if you've worked something before. So let's assume that you might have been a servicer for a particular product or you've purchased a product before. In this case, the batch track information is very useful in helping the clients, helping our clients evaluate something. And right up here, you can see a kind of a traditional triangle report where you can see the placement volumes running up and down the side right there, as well as the collections over time by batch month. And then we've got summaries down at the bottom. Key thing when we're doing those batch tracks that we find a lot of times in working with some of our clients is that they do some math errors, and it's very good to, when you're sharing that information, particularly with us, we like to see the raw data so we can double check the math. But one of the challenges that happens sometimes is that people will have a tendency to use this principal balance column for every single batch month going forward. And unfortunately, what that does is when you do include that information that way, you're over increasing the denominator of your calculation of the liquidation rate. So the numerator is all the prior periods that are related to that, everything that collected in month one, two, or three. But your denominator should only apply to the principal balances of portfolios that are actually old enough to be contributing data to that particular batch month. Seems like a simple issue. I really can't tell you how often I see that mistake made by folks when they're doing calculations on the batch tracks, leading them to potentially underestimate the collections on a portfolio. By extension, it's very easy to overestimate the collections on a portfolio if you're not making sure that your numerators are applicable only to the periods of time in which they actually apply. And sometimes we've seen folks that misapply the calculation and the timing of those actual collections that are coming through. A composite portfolio is something that can happen for you if you've got lots of similar data already stored on your system. So that extent, in our case, what we might do is we might actually build ourselves a little access query, drill into the underlying SQL table storing all of the collections on every account that we've ever financed or bought, and the process allow us to build a composite portfolio. So for example, let's say that you have financed a particular type of consumer loan from one of the providers, let's just call them consumer lender A, but now you're getting ready to buy from consumer lender B. The average balances aren't the same, and the state distributions aren't exactly the same, particularly the mix of those states. But consumer lender A, which you had a lot of experience with, did have a lot of Georgia and Florida accounts, but not very many in Virginia, whereas consumer lender B seems to have a lot more inventory in Virginia. Doing a full batch track, like we talked about a minute ago, probably wouldn't give you a very good comparison. What you're going to want to do is drill down a little deeper and maybe build a composite portfolio of similar assets to the one that you're actually financing. In that case, what we've got here is just a little SQL query that we wrote up to be able to drill down to see what to pull all similar accounts of similar
product types at similar balance ranges to the file that we were looking at. By pulling that information together at a detailed level, we've actually pulled all the account information here to show us a base table that of comparable accounts to what we're looking at financing. We'd also pull the same information for payments at the same unified field code, meaning the account number. And then by comparing those two numbers together, we're able to build a payment history matched at the account level and build a payers analysis and a non-payers analysis to give us right on back to the point that we talked about before, which is a batch track for portfolios for something maybe we'd never financed before. But what we've done is we've identified it by looking at the same types of accounts that we financed before. Just because you don't have experience with the actual originator, you do have the ability by looking at everything that you've looked at before to pull that data out and build yourself a composite portfolio, what we like to call a composite portfolio, of a similar asset to what you financed in the past. The final item that we talk about here before we skip into seller disclosure is scores. Some consumers, some of our clients may contract out a score to one of the major vendors. Others will build their own scores internally. Generally speaking, if you are going to move to that next level, which is building and scoring accounts, you really want to make sure that if you are purchasing a score, many of those providers who sell scores will not only provide you a generic score, a generic recovery score, but they'll also give you at a higher price, a custom recovery score. What they mean by custom recovery score is they'll go into, if you don't have the data mining capabilities or perhaps a data scientist on your staff, they can look at your data for you and tell you how you will collect on particular asset types for data for which you have the information. That's particularly useful because what we've seen repeatedly is that several clients may differ, or debt buyers may differ in how they collect versus other debt buyers. Some people are better at audit efficiency paper than at telecom paper, and some people are better at a particular species of telecom paper versus consumer loans. Having a customized score gives you the benefit of knowing that how you will actually perform rather than how a generic debt buyer will perform. Because as we all know, a generic debt buyer is the average of everyone, and none of us is average. Everyone has their strengths and weaknesses in their particular asset types and the ways that they collect. The item that we want to make sure that clients are working towards as you work through your steps is to examine the seller disclosures, commonly called seller surveys or otherwise seller disclosures. It's very important to ask key questions and to be very detailed in follow-up questions. Simply accepting the template that's provided for a seller survey probably won't give you all the information you need. So while the industry over the 20 years that I've been in it has moved from everyone sending in their own customized questions to now a generic kind of template being provided either by the brokers or by the sellers, the benefit of a seller disclosure is you get an insight into the origination standards under which the accounts were originated, the prior work effort, any potential controls on post-acquisitions, and by reviewing the contract in advance, looking at the contract terms. For example, we've seen on contract terms everything from resale restrictions, which can prove challenging, to also put-back restrictions, saying that accounts have to be put back much faster. So a great example of a challenge with a put-back provision that you'd see would be if you're buying a particularly small account and you have 120 to 180 days to put the accounts back, should be plenty of time for anyone to be able to process those. But imagine instead if you were buying, for example, a very large file, say a 50,000 account transaction or a 140,000 account transaction of healthcare accounts that are 2 to 3 years old. Having only a 60-day putback provision simply will not give anyone, even some of the largest sellers, time enough to drill down at the account level and contact every consumer to ensure that there's no invalid accounts inside the file that need to be put back. So negotiating those terms and understanding what they are as part of your bid is fairly critical. Understanding controls on post-acquisition is important as well. One of the challenges that we've seen lately are, for example, restrictions either on you must use binding arbitration or that you're not permitted to use arbitration or that you're not permitted to use legal or that you can only pursue legal on a certain percentage of the inventory. This is an increasing thing that we've seen recently in trends in some of the seller disclosures and restrictions. Probably bears out from some debt buyers buying files and suing on every account, assuming that that'll improve their overall performance, regardless of the cost. It's also important to understand prior work effort and critically the settlement offers that may have been made on a file. One of the challenges that we find is trying to make sure there's a very clear answer provided regarding prior settlement efforts. We recently, I would say probably about a year ago, Greg, we had looked at a auto deficiency file from a first-time seller, and we were fairly excited to be working with our partner to bring this file on board. In that particular case, as we asked the question, the file, it listed settlement rate, what settlement offers have been made, and it said, you know, 90%. Well, all it said was 90%. That didn't really answer the question of, was it a 90% forgiveness, or was it 90% of balance was due? Because it just said 90% of balance. So we insisted with our partner that they go back and clarify that question. And what we all discovered was that the seller had these 24-month-old auto deficiency accounts, and the seller had been offering up to 90% forgiveness offers on the accounts over the preceding 2 years to try to get these consumers on a subprime auto product to pay. Most of us would understand that will make it very difficult to collect on those accounts. Anyone who refused a 90% forgiveness offer from the originator is probably not going to take you up on your 50% offers. So it just makes the file very difficult to maximize the recoveries on that. We walked away from that particular opportunity in conjunction with our client. We actually had the file brought to us a couple more times, and obviously we provide the same guidance each time. Finally, all of this information gets pulled together. The ART, which is looking at the seller survey and the work structures and work restrictions that may occur on the file, and the science, which is the data mining and all the past experience that we've had in a particular product, to pull that information together to build a liquidation curve. You can see right here what we would look at would be to build, in this case, is a cumulative liquidation curve. We actually look at this both marginally and cumulatively. We find it very helpful to visualize, as well as it's great to look at numbers, but you also need to provide visualizations as well, because that'll help you sometimes to say, yeah, this just doesn't make any particular sense how the curve is being generated at this point in time. So we want to make sure that we're visualizing what's being shown at any given point in time as well. Once we pull that information together with one of our client partners, you'll work to discuss the pricing that you should pay for a particular portfolio and that they should bid. Obviously, this is heavily dependent upon what financing structures you may have. And Flock has a wide variety of financing structures and solutions to work with its various partners, depending upon the amount of risk associated with the opportunity, as well as to talk about whether or not the timing of recoveries and the amount of profit sharing that will exist on the joint investments that we do. You should take your not only just the portfolio's return, but also the cost of funds and the timing and risk associated with those. It's not enough to say that you'll collect a 2.5 times multiple in a portfolio. What matters is how long is it going to take you to get there? Because if you get that money back, the sooner you can redeploy it, and of course, the lower risk that you're exposed to regarding macroeconomic trends that may occur. Once we've had that information together, in our case, we will build a performance table showing what the confidence intervals are for the particular curve, as well as what a potential pricing range is. And you can see here, this little data table allows us to see roughly what the returns would be at different points in time and different prices. This actually is the performance that we had on a particular product that we had looked at, where we were bidding around, we were looking at between 5 and 5.6. Our client decided they wanted to go in on the auction at 5.2, and we were okay with that, obviously. To give themselves a little bit of upside movement in case they were asked to bring the price up, and they were, so we went up to 5.3 in this case and are projecting a 37% portfolio XIRR. And that concludes the details of the stages that we think everyone should be doing for underwriting. I'm available for questions, and I believe Greg is as well. Greg, do you want to add anything to this, or are we ready to move on to our Q&A?
I think we're ready to move on.
Great.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Damon. Really appreciate the presentation. It was very comprehensive. We've gotten one question so far. While are we waiting, if anybody else has a question, now would be the time to type it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Just a question wondering if you think, if you're going to make a copy of the presentation available to the audience.
We haven't discussed that. We will. I think we can. We probably want to sanitize a couple things in here, and if we do, we'll make it available. I'm sure we can make it available as a pre-recorded video of this, though. It shouldn't be a problem.
Well, I'm sure there's other information that you'd be able to send over that would probably sort of mirror what's been part of the presentation so far as well. One question that's come in as we get started and get the ball rolling here. Again, if you have a question, type it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Question is, how do you think about the account level Ethereum priority score and relevant services, which provide the probability of payment in the next 6 months and the expected dollar value that can be collected from the borrower? Credit bureaus have more information than collection agencies, including other loan information, previous transactions, and even their income information.
Right. So that's an interesting question. I think scores from the big three can be very helpful. They're not an end-all be-all solution. I've used them. I prefer to use those as part of an integrated approach to look at things. One of the challenges of using a off-the-shelf score is often that it doesn't predict how you yourself will do. And I'm sure everyone believes that they're a better collector than everyone else on almost every product type. So given that fact, we want to make sure that we build that in our calculations. Most of the credit score providers, as well as other scoring companies out there that you'll run across, can help you build a customized score to help you see how you will do against the database of other consumers. The fact that the credit bureaus have a self-reported consumer gross income is not always an accurate reflection of what the consumer is. If you want to get that information, you'd have to see the consumer's actual tax records to see what actually got recorded, because that otherwise it's self-disclosed information as part of the original credit application that may be somewhat dated. I find that at the end of the day, though, that there's actually considerable research that's come out of both the St. Louis, out of the New York Fed through Liberty Street Economics, the St. Louis Fed, and the Richmond Fed. All of which have pointed out many of the consumers who are defaulting tend to be repeat default entities. So the fact that they've got other credit outstanding, or that you can see their income level, does not necessarily provide you the value of knowing what they're going to do. Again, I think a customized score tailored to how you collect is much more important. That's one of the values that we look for with our clients. Because we have a variety of clients, all of whom collect in different ways.
But the downside is, on a customized score, it can be very expensive and may not warrant the effort for a smaller portfolio. So, I mean, I agree with what Damon is saying, is that these generic scores from the bureaus are very directional. But if you're a legal shop, or if you are a settlement shop, or if you are a payer shop and have different strategies, your performance is going to be a little bit different, and the generic scores are based upon a very broad collection treatment. So you just need to know your paper and know your strategies, and be able to calibrate these scores to your specific collection process. The other thing is that there also are some anomalies within actual portfolios. If you're looking at a consumer loan portfolio, and this is a consumer loan score from the bureaus, the portfolio that you're looking to buy may have higher balances than what the score was built on, or lower balances, or there may be a weighting in a particular geographic area. And you have to adjust those scores accordingly when you're setting your pricing. But it turns into a little bit more of an art form than a science at that point.
And as we talk about consumer economics, the great deleveraging that's actually occurred at the consumer level generally across the last 10 years is putting some posing some challenges for some of those credit scores effectively, which is why some of those credit score companies have started acquiring alternative credit score providers who are able to tap into things like utility bill payments and rent payments and that sort of information to help integrate that into their information.
Excellent. Well, appreciate that. We've got a number of other questions that have come in the past few minutes, so let's take the next one here. How would you approach a portfolio in a vertical in which you truly have no prior experience? For example, you have a history of subprime auto, but want to diversify into consumer loans or fintech.
That's a great question.
That's a great question. The challenge, I think, for folks is if you're an expert in subprime auto and you want to diversify, the first step would be probably keep the file small, try to take it in as a third-party agency, get a little experience understanding that it works very differently. We actually seen that work a little bit more in the opposite direction. We've seen folks who've bought FinTech and then thought they could get into subprime auto, not realizing that while a FinTech product, the person may be challenged to pay the bill. Oftentimes, the first conversation when talking to a subprime auto person is, "I'm not paying you. You took my car away." It doesn't matter to them that they legally owe the deficiency balance. That's their first first response to the consumer. So it's really, you really need to understand what's going to happen, not just from a standpoint, because we can find a way to find comparable products that you may have worked inside the data. For example, if you're looking at credit card products and you finance that all along, there are ways to find comparable accounts and consumers and how they behave to be able to build a composite to a fintech. So that account level modeling that we talked about earlier in building a composite portfolio can be beneficial there. Nonetheless, you get to the art point, which is where I'll toss this over to Greg from his operational experience. There's an art that goes with working accounts that maybe you've never talked to before, and that talk off is very different, isn't it?
Right. But I think, I mean, to answer the question very succinctly, it's like, you know, the first thing to do is find a comparable product or as close as you can and see what your performance on that is. Number two, take a small bite first, or take a small bite as possible first.
Servicing.
The other thing is, one of the things to keep in mind that we didn't talk a whole lot about is that the cost of servicing has a very dramatic impact on the profitability of a portfolio. And on a portfolio that you buy where you don't have a lot of experience, driving down your operational costs will have a dramatic impact on the profitability of the portfolio. And so maybe you need to, you know, cut out the bells and whistles and work this at the lowest possible cost to ensure that you're going to get your principal a little bit of return back. But I think the message is on portfolios where you're going in a little blind, we would warrant caution, a lot of caution, and being very conservative. You know, obviously we all have friends in the industry. You can call around other agencies, find out what kind of their liquidations look like and what kind of strategies they're using. But that doesn't always translate to where you're working that paper.
To your point about sort of the differences from agency to agency in terms of how they operate, their cost structure, things like that, are you looking at also sort of necessarily or kind of in a way underwriting the agency as much as you're underwriting the portfolio? Because you have to see sort of what their performance is, what, you know, sort of, and how they're going to sort of how they're set, you know, how they're set up operationally compares to others in terms of what, you know, what they're going to be able to get in terms of a return.
Well, so let me answer that. And the answer is sort of. And the reason is this, that the way that we operate is that we're really underwriting. When we underwrite, we're underwriting the debt buyer. We're looking for a partner that knows how to solve these types of problems. We don't want to be an agency manager. We don't want to be an agency auditor. We want to partner with somebody who knows how to or can demonstrate that they know how to solve these problems and are a good collector. And I think that most good debt buyers who are liquidating portfolios have a number of different strategies that each apply to different asset classes. And so during our underwriting process, we'll review that and see how they solve problems and how they attack certain portfolios. And then what we do is we pretty much leave it up to that, to our partner, to go ahead and determine who the right agencies are, whether it's a settlement strategy, whether it's a legal strategy, whether it's a letter strategy, or a call on contact strategy to deliver the results that they commit to us. And so that's how we kind of leave it. Now, there are times where we get involved and we offer some advice from observations and our experience, but for the most part, we're underwriting the actual debt buyer and their processes.
Yeah. Thanks. The next question from our audience. Understanding the workflow, what is your methodology for comparing the estimated performance of a potential portfolio versus industry benchmarks for how the portfolio would likely perform and then further comparing against the potential buyer's performance?
Well, the challenge, of course, is when we talk about industry benchmarks, it's not as though anything's actually published. It says credit card liquidates 25% over 36 or 40 months or whatever. There's so many different kinds of portfolios that have been and originated out in the world. It's a little hard to be able to drill down into that level. So what we really are looking to do is to see how you performed yourself against portfolios, and that's what would help us predict how you'll do in the future.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting way to look at this is when you are underwriting the portfolio, what you're really doing is you're generating a curve, which is your benchmark curve, and you want to compare to how you're performing against that curve. And how well, because that's going to drive where you make your margin, where you're making your profit, whether you're making your profit in servicing or whether you're making your profit on return and investment or on collections. And since that national benchmark data isn't available, now we are fortunate, you know, we have a couple thousand, portfolios with hundreds of thousands and millions of observations. We're able to see, you know, if somebody is performing at what we would consider the flock average, so to speak, on a particular asset class, and we're able to provide direction. But somebody who doesn't have that kind of history, I mean, obviously, if you're a Sherman or a PRA, you've got an incredible amount of history to do some benchmarking against. But the average debt buyer only has their own internal performance to look at. And that's one of the kind of advantages that we have because of our breadth of experience.
So one of the things that's an add-on to that as well, one of the benefits of being a flock client is that while the collection systems that you have will help provide you with internal reporting, in flock's case, as a joint investment partner, we actually do see ourselves as a partner. So one of the things that we do is we provide a series of dashboards that are online, restricted only to our client's usage and only of their accounts. So client A doesn't get to see what client B is doing or how they're collecting. They can only see their own information. But on a monthly basis, they're able to log in, and every day thereafter, anytime they want to, on a monthly basis, that data is refreshed, and they're able to see exactly how they're performing against the original benchmarks that were set for the portfolio. So we provide them with a series of completely interactive dashboards in a web-secure environment to where they can log in and see how they're doing on their own investment, how they're doing on the portfolio on a gross basis, on a net basis, over time, against relative to goals, relative to the other portfolios that they own, as well as to see how they're doing on the recoveries necessary to be able to meet any of Flock's terms that we've negotiated with that particular client.
Packages provided by the sellers. Is that a function of your planned legal collections versus non-legal collections?
Absolutely. And finding and getting good media up front if you're going to go heavy legal is very important. It is one of the things that we would factor in the seller disclosures is what's the cost of the media going to be? We all know there's some providers out there that, and I'm dating myself a little bit, that you buy it and within 10 days you'd get a disc, literally a CD in the mail, and don't call me again. Versus now it's online download, so you get your data electronically, but it's the same kind of thing. You get what you get is what you're going to get, and that'll be it. Others, you have to request that data on a period of time basis with a certain percentage free and with the cost thereafter. So all of those factors have to be put together in determining whether or not, you know, that's additional cost that factors into the returns on things. So do we value it? Absolutely. But it varies widely. If it's free, it's definitely a plus. If it's free up front, very much a plus. If it has a cost or it's delivered over time, that's something that has to be factored in your calculation. It also applies to work standards as well. For example, if one of our clients is not planning on going legal until 12 months in ownership of the portfolio because they want to try and squeeze every bit of pre-legal out of it that they can, knowing that they're going to have to start paying costs down the road, we may help them understand they may need to adjust their strategy to go legal a little earlier so they understand or at least scrub the accounts that they're going to go legal for earlier so they'll know which ones they need to request the data on before it stops being free.
Customer level data, such as the date of birth and CBR data points when evaluating the portfolio given the CFPB regulations?
The data information is provided to you. You're absolutely entitled to use that information to help you estimate whether or not how the portfolio is going to collect. I mean, I'm not aware there's actually a restriction from the CFPB that says that accounts that I'm either reviewing or that I've already funded that I can't take a look at how old they are or anything like that.
But you know, it's kind of interesting. David and I have had this conversation a number of times. You know, that's why the stratification process is so important, because you are stratting those types of things. And, you know, there was a portfolio that I had solicited and brought into Damon, and I was all excited about this particular portfolio. And Damon came back to me and said, did you know that like 80% of this portfolio are people over the age of 72 years old? And that has a direct that has a direct impact on how you would price that particular portfolio. You know, people at that age have judgment-proof income
and judgment-proof assets, because they'll collapse down to a single bank account into which their Social Security is required to be direct deposited. And now you can't garner a bank account. You can't do a bank. You can't do a bank levy. You try to do a wage garnishment, and they'll quit their Walmart greeter job. And the next thing you know, you're not able to get any money out of them.
So there's a lot of so it is very important to use all the tools that are provided to you, and all the data that's provided to you. And that's one of the ways. You know, we've looked at that very closely. But at this time, we're not known of any restriction of not changing the price based upon age. It doesn't necessarily mean that we wouldn't bid on the portfolio. We just wouldn't have the same value as something a little younger.
Our next question: do you think the pricing is more dependent on the collection agency's performance, and how do you determine legal collection percentage in the pricing process?
Okay, so I'm assuming that they're looking at a comparison. If you were to price a portfolio and you're trying to construct that price, how much of that price is attributable to collections from a collection agency at a contingency fee versus legal collections with legal costs plus a contingency fee and the time that it takes to collect it? We have very detailed models that we take. First off, we take the debt buyer, our actual partner strategy, whatever strategy that they're going to use on this portfolio, and then we overlay the costs associated with that strategy and the liquidations expected. So we have some folks out there that are a heavy legal shop, and they start legal at month 4 and 5, and we start laying in the legal costs, and then we start ramping up the legal liquidations, you know, at some 6 months after those costs start generating. And we tail those out for a long, long time, because once you get somebody into a legal process, the tail on the payer is a long, long tail. So I don't think there's a way for us to say exactly how we allocate between collections and legal.
Because it varies based on the strategy of our partner. Whatever our partners have different strategies, and that just varies. Sometimes we're, you know, some partners are more willing to do legal and take a longer view, and some are looking to get their money back faster and turn the capital faster.
But a very interesting view on this is something we've run into a number of times. We do have situations where we have people who buy portfolios and they do very, very well over the first 12 months of the portfolio, and we start seeing liquidations drop off after month 12. And when we go back and we look at it, we kind of do a post-mortem on it, we find out that the operations team was watching those liquidations and noticed, God, we're doing so well, we don't have to go to legal. We don't have to incur that additional expense of legal. Gosh, we're doing great. And so they delay the start of legal. The problem, what they didn't account for, is that legal has a good 6 month ramp time. From the moment you start suing an account and putting it into the legal process, it takes 6 to 9 months before you start generating revenue. So you hit this trough. So even if you're doing really well in the first 6 or 9 months, you do need to start feeding that legal engine if that's a part of your collection strategy, because you're not going to see those results until month 18 to 24.
I know that there's been more of an interest from first-time debt purchasers in the past year or so, as the supply becomes a little bit more available, or as new asset classes become available to purchase. Curious what advice you would give to someone who's just really kind of starting out, those first few steps on how to get the ball rolling if they wanted to start looking at buying a portfolio.
So real quick on the industry as a whole, what we do see, we're seeing two very different kind of influences in the market today. Right now, we're seeing a number of very large debt buyers implode for a variety of different reasons, whether they were overpaying, whether their financing fell apart, whether there was a relationship breakdown. But there are four or five large debt buyers who are exiting the business under duress. In the same same time I say that, I've got five or six new debt buyers who are entering into the market, who are seeing opportunities, especially in fintech, to pick up portfolios and to be and who want to get into that space, and they've acquired some money to go ahead and finance them to buy this debt. So it's kind of exciting because we're seeing some people come out, we're seeing people come in, there's some excitement, and there's a lot of opportunity in this space right now. My personal feeling is, you know, in terms of how you go about doing this, is number one, probably the biggest hurdle is the licensing hurdle. And you need to figure out how you're going to get the licensing in the required states. And you need to do that in advance of actually generating any revenue. It's kind of a sunk cost. And so once you solve that particular problem, it's a matter of capital. Do you have a partner that can help provide you capital so that you're not coming completely out of pocket, or do you have that capital yourself? And I would start off slow. I would buy some smaller portfolios and start working those portfolios while you work out all your processes, while you work out what agencies you're going to deploy paper to, what you're going to do from a legal perspective, and how you're going to handle all of the transfer of funds and documents that you need to do. Once you have that worked out, you can start to ramp up your buying efforts and you know, kind of building on what you've already kind of established in those processes and procedures. But you know, a common mistake we see is somebody who comes out, their first purchase is a very large portfolio. And the problem is once you get behind on a portfolio, you get 3 or 4 months behind on collections on a portfolio, it's extremely difficult to catch up, and you start, you know, it starts hurting your actual investment to the point of losing principal.
We knew a debt buyer that had managed to work their way into placing a very aggressive bid at one point in time on a portfolio of auto portfolios, and the probable fair value for that asset was probably about a penny and a half, and they had bid 3.41%. And they did it in 1 month, and they bought it again 2 or 3 months later before they realized that they had vastly overpaid. Well, now they're in deep for over $10 million in borrowed funds to try to be able to recover. And it's going to be one of those cases that Greg was just mentioning where they're going to end up exiting under duress under that. Okay.
Okay. Let's see. Our next question here. Could you rank the collection performance by the asset class based on your historical experience and share the average gross liquidation rate or any other insight if convenient? Is that something you have access to?
Not readily available to us, but it is information that we've got. Obviously, it helps us to look at things. But it really applies, you know, certain products pay a little faster and a little bit better, and other products don't. If you think about it, it's a multi-dimensional analysis that you've got to look at. You've got asset types going down one dimension, then you've got aging of the asset going across another dimension. But then inside that dimension of the asset class, you've got work strategy that was done prior to your acquisition, service stage. So it's a little challenging to think about that. But generally speaking,
We have the data. We've
got the data.
And we have the data, and when our partners ask us to help them identify where they should be spending their money, we use that data to help them do that. But the other thing you kind of really need to keep in mind is it really depends on what you're paying for that asset is really what's important, because maybe you'll take a lower liquidating asset because you're paying significantly lower and you can make a higher margin on it. And so we're very ROI and IRR sensitive when we do these kind of transactions. We also are very sensitive to the length of time that it takes to recap principal and interest on these deals.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about it, we're really very IRR sensitive, because the reality is that for those of us who've been in this industry for as long as we have, we've been through a couple of ups, we've been through a couple of downs, both in pricing and economic conditions. We've seen recessions come and go. We're in a multi-year expansion. Right now, most of the economic indicators tend to suggest that's not going to end anytime in at least the next 12 months, but there's no bet beyond that point in time. So if you're focusing on ROI exclusively because you're building up what you think is a payer base over a multi-year period of time, if the economy tanks 12 to 14 months from now, suddenly that projection is out of whack. And that's why the IRR is so important, because it takes into account the speed with which the money comes back. So we do tend to focus a little bit more on that, and different products behave more positively than others. Other products come back very, very fast. We have seen that payday loans and charged-off paper, particularly fresher ones, pay very quickly. Money comes back 6 to 9 months, and then it just dies in terms of recovery rate. So if you haven't managed to get your on a net basis, your purchase price back in 12 months, you may never recover your purchase price back on that product, just because the consumers don't pay as it gets older.
Well, those are all the questions we have in the queue right now, and we've just about run out of time, but maybe before we wrap up for the day, Greg and or Damon, if you wanted to share any sort of parting thoughts, a summary, any key takeaways, before we wrap up.
Just wanted to thank everybody for their time. We apologize for the technical difficulties we had at the start of the session. I think us at Flock, we're still very excited about this industry. We think that the volumes are growing. We all know that there are some very, very major players who are still sitting on the sideline, and we're hopeful that at some point in time when they come back to the market, it will be a very, very big boon. But we are still seeing very attractive returns and new credit grantors coming to the market each day with new assets, distressed assets for sale. So we're very excited about it. And, if there's anybody out there that is interested in getting into this business or is looking to talk more about what they're doing and how we might be able to help, feel free to reach out to us. We're always happy to talk and meet new people and learn about what you're doing in your businesses and how we might be able to help them.
I think that's great, Greg. The biggest thing that I would say is make sure that you have a process, have discipline, define your steps, and make sure you follow them. And make sure you don't let emotion get in the way when you're making a bid. That'll help you make the best return you possibly can. The emotion comes later on when you bid successfully and making a nice profit.
That's what it's time to celebrate. Well, Damon, Greg, thank you very much for the presentation today. Thanks for answering all the questions. Really appreciate your participation. Thanks to Flock Specialty Finance for sponsoring today's webinar. Thanks to everybody who participated, who asked questions, and who listened. Really appreciate your time. Stay tuned stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. And I hope everybody enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Bye.